This is Dean calling from Ireland, and Gangnam Wire is the best true crime podcast. We love the mob stories over here.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Here in the classic old ice house in Midtown Kansas City with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, first of all, tonight, we're going to talk about Oney Madden again. You know, just got done with some podcast on the Irish mob in New York City, and something came up and caused me to do a little more research about something I didn't really know anything about. But first, I want to share with you guys some really nice compliments we got on Facebook. Here's JT Pinair. He says, not to dredge up an old post, but I came across your podcast via a link someone posted in a comment on a thread I was following on Bob Berdella. I have to say that I'm hooked. I've been working my way through your archives. I really dig what you do. He liked that, Aaron. He really digs what we do.
He digs what we do.
He digs what we do. Bob Berdella, they dug up his yard and found a head. I wonder if that's what he means. JT, I know that's not what you mean. We're just having a little fun with it.
Yeah, they dug what Bob Berdella did. Two scoops, I think, is what we called it.
Two scoops, yeah. And his second overturning of the shovel, they found the
skull.
The skull with some of the hair still attached. You know that skull that's not an old Indian skull there, buddy. That's a recent skull. There's Anna Garcia. She says, Gangland, number one.
Does it say where Anna's from?
No, it doesn't. It was a Facebook thing, and I think I looked her up. She's kind of a new follower, and I think it didn't have any personal information at all. Actually, a lot of people, I look up their personal information and see where they're from. So that's just a couple of recent new subscribers and followers. We have more. We have, I talked about him already once, Dean from Ireland. Dean was kind enough to call Claire over here from Ireland and give me a nice little audio clip to lead into Gangland Wire. So that'll be fun to have an Irish accent on there. Any more of you? I'd like to get some more accents. We got any Australian accents that would call up here to my cell phone, 816-931-3535, and just leave a message that says, hey, my name is XYZ, and we love Gangland Wire down here in Australia, or we love Gangland Wire down under.
Or wherever you listen to it from.
Whether it be Sweden. I've got some followers from Sweden. I know that. And I had a police officer who got hold of me, and he said, I discovered your podcast. I like it so much, I volunteered to drive the paddy wagon last night so I could just binge on your episodes all night long. You see, a paddy wagon driver, they don't really answer calls other than if somebody calls them. They go and pick somebody up, put them in the back, and haul them into the jail, and then deposit them in the jail, and then go back out and wait for the next call. So they have a little bit of downtime when they can listen to the podcast. So we're getting more and more followers. We're getting more from all over. We're running, but we're getting 20,000-25,000 downloads every month. More people, more your friends you can get to listen to Gangland Wire, the more likely we are to get a sponsor, and we can start getting a little money for this thing. Either that, or if you don't want us to have a sponsor, everybody needs to send in a quarter an episode. That would do it for us, just a quarter an episode. Dollar a month would be fine.
That would be great. You know, you may put on the beginning of this episode the Jurassic Jerky
commercial. Oh, yeah, commercial. The Jurassic Jerky commercial. I'll put that on there.
I did the voicing for. That,
right.
It's not really a sponsor, but rather somebody that we set in arrangements. If you buy the jerky and you use the discount code GANG10, you get a dollar. We get a dollar.
We get $1.60, and you get 10% off. We probably shouldn't tell them how much we get.
Well, it's not much, really. That's why we're saying send us the quarter.
Send us a quarter an episode, a dollar a month. If we got 2,000 people to send us a dollar a month, why, we'd be happy. We could pay our studio rent, and I'd probably hire somebody to go edit this thing for me, because that takes me quite a little bit of time. Although, I don't know, I probably would want to keep my own personal touch on it to edit it. Maybe, too, we'd buy some more new equipment, more than likely. We'd give Aaron a little extra money. We'd give Aaron a little tip, since he probably didn't get many tips this weekend over at Chubby's. Was it a slow weekend at Chubby's this last weekend?
You know, it depends on the time of the month, the end of the month. Is this, like, this weekend probably going to be pretty quiet,
because
Labor Day weekend, we're recording this a week before Labor Day weekend, a lot of folks going out of town, and the folks, of course, not going out of town probably don't have a lot of money.
Oh, you know, Aaron, I had somebody ask me, said, what's the deal with Aaron? How come he doesn't have a driver's license or drive a car? I said, because he's poor, man.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I had a car at one point I'd bought for $1,000.
You had that old van. I remember you had.
Yeah, the Scooby-Doo mobile.
Yeah.
I had that for quite a while. But then I had gotten a Toyota Tercel for like, or no, it was a Corolla. It was like a 99 Corolla I got from the pick and pull.
Ah, really?
For like $1,000. Yeah. Drove the thing for three years. And then it went out on me, which was kind of an odd thing when it going out, because I'd already had other things seemed to go wrong. One day I went home from work in the morning, you know, because I work overnight.
Yeah.
My car, there it was, parked on the on 37th right there in the hill, facing west. And I go upstairs, I go to sleep, come down 8 hours later, I come outside, my car's like 30 feet further down the hill.
Oh, really?
this is all Willy stuff. Which is what I think kind of happened to the car.
Man.
Just, you know.
Car was haunted.
Not haunted.
It was possessed.
Yeah, it was possessed by a baby's daddy.
Oh. Somebody was messing with you.
I think that's what it was the baby's daddy.
Oh, I see. I got you now. Well, you know, when you live and work within two or three blocks of and everything you do is within five or six blocks, well, you don't really have to have a car.
I don't. I mean, it would help, but I don't have to have it. And, of course, I worry about having problems with the car again.
Right.
Because I don't have a garage or anywhere to keep it secure.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, my studio's six blocks away. You know, Westport's right there. Food, take the bus.
Yeah.
The only thing that's hard sometimes, going out and doing stand-up comedy gigs.
Yeah, that's...
I get a lot of emails for those, and not many of them pay enough that it's worth going, but when they do, then I got to wrangle somebody else with a car.
Yeah, because they're mainly out of town.
Right? Yeah, most all the paid gigs are out of town.
Yeah, well. All right.
Like, I got one coming up here in October. I think it's the 13th or 14th of October at Whiteman Air Force Base.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool. You already got a ride down there?
That's Elliot.
Oh, Elliot's going to take you down?
Oh, well, no, we're working the club. We're working the gig together.
He's working it with you.
Yeah, I'm not headlining that one, unfortunately.
So is that like an officer's club on the base?
Or I'm not sure.
Enlisted man's club? I don't know how that works anymore. It used to be you had the M Club, which was for enlisted men, and then you had the officer's club.
I did a show years ago. This must have been like 2003 at... We were on the base, and it was kind of an ordeal to get through security. Like, if I have a Missouri ID, so I could get on the base, but without any ID, I wouldn't get on the base.
Yeah, right now, you can't get on those bases hardly at all.
It's very difficult. When it turns out, you know, just being a comedian isn't necessarily enough. You need to say, I'm the act. See, the poster, that's me.
Yeah, get out and do it.
And they look at the poster, and it's an old photo, and they don't really believe it's me.
Do a little song and dance and tell a couple of jokes.
Yeah, that's always what they want. Well, tell me a joke. You're a comedian. And
a real comedian, aren't you? As they throw you up against the wall and handcuff you and drag you off to the brig.
I mean, getting on the base, that was pretty cool. Whiteman Air Force Base is the B-2 base.
Right, that's cool.
So that was very cool. And I years ago, I did a show there again, but we did it off base across the street. They had, I don't know if it was an officer's club or whatever, and I did it a third time, same place at that officer's club. So now I'm not sure. Hmm. Another time I did a show. It was down in Oklahoma, northeast Oklahoma. There's a military base where they build the Moab, the mother of all bombs.
Oh, I didn't know about that one.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of the base off the top of my head, but we had to get on the base. It's where they build basically, you know, ordnance.
Interesting.
But if you ever want a comedian, you know, you can always get in touch with me through the Big Dumb Fun Show. Hi, it's Aaron from Gangland Wire. When Gary's not here, I break open the beef jerky, but not just any jerky. I break open the Jurassic Jerky. That's right. Go on over to JurassicJerkyLLC.com and put in your order for some tasty snack meat treats. If you love beef jerky, then you've got to get the carnivore candy from Jurassic Jerky. Put in the promo code GANG10 and you'll get 10% off the entire purchase order. There's my order coming in now. Well, so we talked about Oney Madden.
Right. We talked about Oney Madden and being one of the early Irish mob bosses. And I mentioned, I just kind of, it was mentioned in passing a way that he got into promoting and gambling on boxing and promoting boxing and managing boxers. Back in the, when these young immigrants first came over, and these young Irish and Italian guys, and a lot of, they didn't speak English real well. Sometimes they didn't speak English at all at first. And a lot of your normal jobs are not really open to them. And they came from a very macho culture, both of them. And, you know, professional boxing was a kind of a manly way out of the crushing poverty that they'd been born into. You know, their parents, the only reason they came here because they could hardly eat in the old country. And so they came over here and they had to take the low-end jobs and had a lot of kids. And so they were all born into crushing poverty. And, you know, besides being a professional criminal, boxing might be a way out. So, Joey Iupa up in Chicago, he was a professional boxer when he was real young, fought under an Irish name, Joey O'Brien, because he thought that Irish boxers were probably more popular than Italian boxers, and probably because there's a much larger Irish contingency of people at this point in our country. I don't know how it stands now, but back then there was many more Irish people than there were Italian people.
Maybe a lot more Irish boxers.
A lot more Irish boxers. You know, the Irishmen drinking and fighting, that's the two national sports over there. And what they say about Irishmen, if it wasn't for whiskey, they'd have ruled the world. Now, during this time, when Madden was a young guy, he was a huge boxing fan, and it was observed by people in the media as they got to know who he was, and they wrote about this, that when he was watching a boxing match, he would jump up and scream advice and get out in the aisles and shadow box and generally act like a crazed fan at one of these World Wrestling Foundation matches. But he was a huge boxing fan.
Any relation to John Madden?
I don't think so. I don't know. We'd have to look that one up. But, you know, John Madden, he's kind of a big, brash guy. Now, Oney was not a big guy. He was a real good-looking guy, but he was more of a normal-sized guy. John Madden's a big, kind of loud dude, but I suppose he could be a relative. It could be
a
grandson or a nephew or something.
You got to edit this part out where I say I did that joke in the pre-tape session, and I just put it back into the episode.
Really?
Gary played along with it really well, though.
Well, we talked about Oney Madden's relationship with a boxer named Primo Canera. Now, I had some vague memory of Primo Canera, but I didn't really remember that much about him. And so I thought I'd look up Primo Canera and what his connection was to Oney Madden. Primo Canera was born in 1906 in Italy, in Venice, Italy. And he was huge. They say he weighed 15 to 20 pounds at birth. And as he grew up, he did not get any smaller compared to the other kids. The Canera family soon realized they had a great potential in their broad-shouldered son, who was much bigger and stronger than everybody else. First as a laborer, but then he became kind of a local attraction, an early...
Like a strong man?
Like a strong man, yeah. In the early 20th century, in rural northern Italy, before these guys came over here, everybody, there was deep poverty over there. And the Canera family were peasants, and they did their best to promote their son and see that he could earn them some money. By the age of 16, Primo had moved to France, and his first job in France was as strong man as a circus. It wasn't long he was recruited into professional boxing sport and fought many fights over in Europe. A lot of these were rumored to be fixed. He was known as a simple, gentle giant who was easily manipulated by his handlers. His humble origins, he probably didn't read or write at all, left him ill-equipped for the limelight. And they left him even less equipped to understand that he was fighting in some crooked title fights and that people were making money off of him. He actually was the beneficiary of the most crooked title fights in heavyweight boxing history. He grew to be 6'6" tall. Now, that doesn't sound so big anymore in this day of 7-foot basketball players, but in early 1900s, that was huge. Most men were around 5'10", 5'9". If you were 6 foot, you were pretty tall. And he weighed in at 260 pounds, and he was heavily muscled. He was an imposingly large man by any standards. And for Italians, Italians are really not usually that big. He was a giant. He became a celebrity in the 1920s in Europe. 1929, just before the stock market crash, he came to the U.S. on a highly publicized series of boxing matches against American boxers. And he was a media attraction immediately. Primo was the media loved him because of his size and his looks. He had, you know what Andre the Giant looks like here?
Yeah, I remember Andre the Giant.
Well, he had this one of these great big heads as well as a great big body and kind of a big old Roman nose, we call him. And he looked a little bit like Andre the Giant. He was probably better looking than Andre the Giant, but that's what he looked like when he was walking down the street. So the media loved him. He was well known for giving funny answers because of his language problems, and I can't begin to mimic that, but you can imagine he's a young Italian guy that speaks barely speaks English, so he has a pronounced Italian accent, and it's easy to give a funny answer when you have a problem with the language. Like, for example, he was once asked how old he was, and he replied, 275. Well, that's how much he weighed, was 275 pounds.
So he wasn't necessarily understanding English as well as speaking it.
No.
When's your birthday? 275. How much do you weigh? December 2nd.
There you go. Well, during the 1920s and 1930s, like we said, Oney Madden was kind of the king of Hell's Kitchen. And during this time, he financed a lot of amateur boxing clubs, and he really was, it was kind of a way he gave back to the community in a way, but also as a way that he developed young fighters. But he's credited with keeping a lot of young guys out of trouble with the law by keeping them busy in the boxing match and giving them ways to expend their energy and kind of an organization with some rules that they were supposed to adhere to. His partner, Frenchie LaMange, he threw in with the guy that owned the Cotton Club and a bunch of other nightclubs in Manhattan and on up to Harlem. The Cotton Club was in Harlem. The most famous club they owned was a guy named Frenchie LaMange. And they both were really interested in Primo Canera. And when he got here, he ended up signing Primo Canera to be his like owner, I guess, his promoter and everything, and they both became corner men at his fights, and they were often seen giving fight advice during the breaks between the rounds. Now, Primo, he didn't understand. He just knew that he wanted to box, and everybody liked him if he boxed, and he seemed to be winning a lot. And the law enforcement and the boxing commission and everybody knew that these matches were being fixed. Nobody could prove it. And the New York State Boxing Commission was continually investigating, but they couldn't get a break in this. Oney Madden he was fixing the fights, and then he was betting on them or get surrogates to go bet on him so he can make money.
But so he's throwing the fights, and what seems most obvious is Primo Canera maybe not that good of a boxer?
He's not that good of a boxer, but everybody's fighting is throwing the fights. Mm-hmm. He is winning. He's winning. He thinks he's winning because he's good. He doesn't know any better. He triumphs with knockouts in 89 of 103 professional fights in the United States. Later, the Boxing Commission would learn that all of his opponents were bribed or intimidated or susceptible to any number of other dirty tricks. In one particular situation, the guy wouldn't take a bribe. He wouldn't be intimidated, and they put some kind of a, not a poison, but some kind of sedative in with his water that he drank. And so as he'd drink water in each round, he'd get this sedative that was sapping his energy and making him tired and sleepy. And as the fight wore on and he drank more water, he just wore down more and more and more. And Primo Canera beat him. One thing that nobody knew was that Primo Canera, except Oney Madden and his handlers, that Primo Canera had what we call a glass jaw. If one of these fighters would have hit him just right on the chin, it would have been a knockout immediately. His only defensive trait, his only fighting skill, was that he was so big, and he was clumsy, and he was huge. So unless somebody were able to really pop him right on the jaw, he was hard to beat, and it's even harder to beat when you're already taking money or you're afraid to win anyhow. He was immensely popular. He always drew crowds wherever he went. He gave the reputation of a dumb oaf. The newspapers nicknamed him the Ambling Alp for the way that he kind of staggered around the ring. He was not like, Muhammad Ali, float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. He was not dancing, no rope-a-dope for Primo Canera. He was stumbling around and just using his extra weight and the fact that the other opponents had been bribed or intimidated into losing. You need to look on my website and see this picture of this guy. It's quite amazing when you see it. His life story or parts of his story, he seemed to grab everybody's imagination back in this time. I'm not sure what it was. You probably had to be there to understand it. His early life as a circus strongman was told in a famous movie called La Strada by director Federico Fellini, and that was released in 1954. There was a boxing columnist named Bud Schulberg, who was also a Hollywood screenwriter. In 1947, he wrote a short novel about prize fight corruption called The Harder They Fall, and it was loosely based on the career of Primo Canera and his relationship with Oney Madden. He ended up writing a screenplay with the same title, in which it depicted a giant immigrant who spoke broken English, and he was taken advantage of by hustling fight promoters and gangsters. And in the plot of The Harder They Fall in the movie, the gangsters sent him unknowingly into fight after they had put the fix in and then siphoned off most of his personal money, and they also made large bets because they knew the fix was in. The film The Harder They Fall was released in 1956 and starred Humphrey Bogart. And he's one of the he's like the Oney Madden character, I would say. I tried to find that on YouTube, and I could find a trailer, but you could get it on YouTube, but you had to pay $2.99 or something. And I was going to do it, and I don't know, I just kind of ran out of time.
The film, The Harder They Fall, was released in 1956 with a starring role for Humphrey Bogart as one of the men who helps to con the young boxer.
Yeah, that role for Bogey was probably like the Oney Madden character, maybe. I could see him playing a character like Oney Madden. You know, it's another connection to Hollywood that one member of the Oney Madden team, shall we say, had. He was really closely connected to George Raft, and I mentioned that before. George Raft came out of Hell's Kitchen and ended up going to the movies. But he had originally been a member of Oney Madden's gang. It was in 1932, George Raft was given a role in Howard Hawks' classic Scarface, Shame of a Nation. Now, the more recent Scarface is with Al Pacino is quite popular. And so Scarface was a nickname for Al Capone. So, you know, if they start calling you Scarface instead of the Blade, Aaron, why, we'll be asking what you've been up to over there at Chubby's. You've been booking the bets over there. What have you been doing? They start calling you Scarface.
No, I've been rolling them off.
Rolling them off, yeah. You're the bouncer over there. You come in and he gets you one of those big movie scars to put on your face, and then you can be the bouncer dressed in black and stand there at the door and glare at everybody when they come in.
Oh, I already do that.
Oh, you already do that. You know, about the time Primo Canera was here during the 30s, he came over here in 1929 and started, and his boxing career ran all through the 30s during the Depression. George Raft was rising in Hollywood, but he kept one foot in Hollywood and one foot firmly back in the New York underworld where he'd been raised. He kept his lifelong friend, Oney Madden, and stayed connected to him, and especially in particular with this Primo Canera. And Oney Madden, of course, was the murdering, bootlegging Hell's Kitchen gang leader who had a tight grasp on the city's illegal rackets there on the west side. And in particular, Oney Madden ran all the prize fighting. He knew who was going to win and who was going to lose. Raft, who had been a boxer at one time in his younger life, and he'd lost 10 of 21 fights by knockout. He was a natural choice to help out running the prize fighting game. He could slip into Madison Square Garden dressing rooms relatively unnoticed and later told a story about how he did so one night prior to one of Canera's bouts. Raft's biographer would tell this later that mentioned this story before that I'll tell you who it was. Now, Canera's opponent that evening was Big Boy Peterson, who was another huge, oversized fighter. Big Boy Peterson had refused to throw the fight, and Oney Madden's interest in the Italian fighter, and not to mention the money, really meant that this was a major problem for all the criminals who handled Canera. They'd all bet on him to win. Raft was the perfect one to fix the problem, so he was able to slip in and out of Madison Square Garden without being noticed, not anybody paying much attention to him, and he got into Peterson's dressing room, and he spiked the fighter's drink, like I said before, and he came out of the ring so woozy that after a couple of three rounds, Canera knocked him out. This was Primo Canera's Madison Square Garden debut. You know, Madison Square Garden, that was the center of professional boxing from the 30s all the way up to the 50s. I remember watching boxing with my dad in the 50s. And they always came from Madison Square Garden. To me, Madison Square Garden just was synonymous with professional boxing. I don't know if you remember that or not, Aaron.
I remember because my grandfather would watch a lot of that boxing. Same thing out of Madison Square Garden.
Madison Square Garden. By the time of this incident, George Raft had done worse things than tamper with boxing matches because he'd grown up in the tenements of Hell's Kitchen and ran with the street gang and was Oney Madden's kind of buddy and lieutenant for a while. He used to say later on that, talking about his upbringing, in my neighborhood, a boy without a knife was like Babe Ruth without a ball bat. It was under similar conditions that a lot of other fighters lost to Canera, and most were known to agree to the arrangements. But sometimes the boxing commission, the only thing they could do, they would fine the boxers with what they called lack of effort. Now, I've never heard of that, where a guy gets in and just lays down. They know he's laying down, he's throwing the fights, and the only thing they can do is give him a fine by the boxing commission. Say it was lack of effort. You ever heard of that, Aaron?
No.
I had not heard of that.
Not for boxing.
Yeah, no, I've never heard of that for any athletic event where the organization, you know, would be professional football or Major League Baseball or minor league teams where they could fine you for lack of effort. Of course, you like to think anybody that's in there doing that is always expending their greatest effort, although every once in a while they don't. You know, Lefty Rosenthal fixed a few professional college basketball games, and those guys
They didn't get fined for lack of effort, did they?
No, they got booted out of baseball or basketball forever, and he took a hit on. He took a conviction.
So, did Canera ever get a title shot?
You know, finally in 1933, he had a shot at the world championship title. And the man he needed to beat was Jack Sharkey. Jack Sharkey was an American guy. He was he was kind of like the Great White Hope against this Italian upstart. And he had a long and storied career. He was the only fighter to ever face both Jack Dempsey and Joe Louis. So he'd been around, and he had actually fought Canera once before. And Sharkey had dominated before, but he got a shot at him again. So in their second bout, there was 40,000 people gathered in Madison Square Garden. And Canera did not want to be beat again by this guy. I forgot to mention that Sharkey beat him in 1931. Canera had developed quite a little bit. He'd learned a little bit more about boxing and had some awareness of how he could use his size to his advantage. And by the sixth round, Canera's reach seemed to be getting the better of Sharkey. And his arms are almost twice as long as most other normal boxers. Like I said, you got to look at that picture of him. It's amazing. whenever he was able to keep Sharkey away, and when he could keep him away, it kind of opened him up. It kind of opened him up to uppercuts. The Ambling Alp, as Kinnear was known, just kept hitting him with these uppercuts, and finally he knocked him down and knocked him out, and he became the true heavyweight champion of the world. Sharkey always insisted that this had been a fair loss, that he had not taken a dive at all, but it said that even his wife had her doubts. I don't know. But if it was a fix, it was a pretty convincing fix, and most people at the time believed that Sharkey was actually fairly beaten by Kinnear. This was a disgraceful loss for Sharkey. He couldn't hardly take it, because this guy that he fought was a stumble bum to most professional boxers, except they just kept taking dives because they were getting paid.
But he'd gotten better.
He'd gotten better. That's true. He'd gotten better. Now, fight fans today still debate about the legitimacy of this much contested win. They say in some fight footage that after he wins, Kinnear picks up one of his corner men off his feet and shakes him around like a rag doll in a celebratory embrace. I have to look that up. That's probably on YouTube. Well, Kinnear was able to maintain his world championship belt for just 1 year. During that year, his celebrity eclipsed everything else. His snaggletooth grin graced the cover of Time magazine. He turned up playing himself in a Hollywood film, The Prize Fighter and the Lady. And what kind of interesting, co-starring him was a future opponent, boxer Max Baer. And even as a champ, Kinnear struggled with money, probably because of all these, Oney Madden and all these other crooks that were around him were taking a lot of his money. He ended up declaring bankruptcy during the 1930s. In 1934, he had to defend his title against the formidable Max Baer, who would never take a dive. Max Baer, and I said before, I thought he was the German. That was Max Schmeling. Max Baer was German ancestry, but he was actually an American. And he is the father of Max Baer. Was it Max Baer? Jethro D. Bodine.
I was going to say, was that the father of...
He was.
Jethro Bodine?
He was.
The Beverly Hillbillies.
He was the natural father of Jethro D. Bodine. Max Baer, just like Jethro.
Isn't he Max Baer Jr.?
Yeah, he is. The Max Baer Sr. was kind of like his son, was real outgoing, a real crowd pleaser himself. And a lot of people loved him, and this made for a real exciting title fight between the popular Primo Kinnear, who was the gentle giant, and Max Baer, who was like the Muhammad Ali of his time. He could float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. He was much smaller, but he was light on his feet, and he had a really strong right hand. By the end of the first round, he had already scrambled Kinnear's brains and had him up against the ropes and was just beating him like a stepchild, like a red-headed stepchild. Kinnear hung in there, and it lasted 9 more rounds before the the referees stopped the fight. And Max Baer won by the TKO, or technical knockout. They said it was a brutal beating, with Kinnear hitting the canvas at least 10 times. He knocked him down 10 times, this huge giant falling 10 times.
But he must have been somewhat tough. He got back up.
He got back up. You're right. You got to hand him that, don't you, Aaron?
You're the father of Jethro Bodine. I am not going to get beat by you right away.
Right away. Well, after the loss of the world championship title, Kinnear's dire financial situation grew even worse, and Oney Madden had other troubles of his own. He was in trouble with the other mob guys, and the Italians were tired of him, and they wanted, if you remember, they wanted his control of some of his, not the Javits Center, that came along later under Mickey Spillane, but they wanted him out. It was an ongoing fight for 30 years. Before Jimmy Coonan came along, and they actually took over all the Irish rackets, but they wanted Oney Madden out. He had other people in the Irish mob scene that wanted him out too, and he ended up leaving New York City for Hot Springs. And when he did that, he just dropped Kinnear, and he said that he claimed he was just sick of defending him against all the different press claims that all the fights were crooked. But in fact, Madden was not an American citizen at this time. He would eventually become an American citizen, and immigration would look at him every once in a while. If he'd get too much attention from law enforcement and the press, immigration would start paying attention to him, and they were paying a lot of attention to Canara because he'd been over here since 1930 without any papers, fighting, and they were looking at Canara, and Madden wanted to stay away from Canara. Canara would go on and fight several more fights and lose all of them over the next 4 years, or most of them. Maybe not all of them, but most of them. Finally, in 1938, at the age of 32, he returned to Italy. By this time, he had, there's something called gigantitis, and he had a lot of kidney problems. He had diabetes and no money. He was able to star in a few Italian films until the war came along, and of course, he was in Italy during the war and Mussolini and all that, so he was at the end of his career. He was in poor health.
End of his career, he was 32.
Well,
I mean, okay, so then war comes
34, 35. He's in his end of his career as a boxer.
From 38 to 45, that's like 7 years. So he's not even 40 years old.
Right, but he's the end of his career as a boxer, professional boxer. I guess that might sound a little better. Thanks for correcting me on that.
Oh, I just think that, yeah, you're right. Any boxer, how long a career do they have?
Yeah, well, some of them, Muhammad Ali lasted a long time, but most of them, I think by age 30, they're pretty well done. In the 1950s, he made a bit of a comeback and was actually made some money as a professional wrestler over in Europe. This is another opportunity for Hollywood to use Primo Canara as his life story or part of his life story as fodder for a movie script. In 1962, there's a movie called Requiem for a Heavyweight. Starred Anthony Quinn as a former washed-up professional boxer who was, spoke broken English, who was large, who was bigger than life in many ways. Jackie Gleason as a corrupt fight promoter, and Mickey Rooney as a corrupt fight manager. Jackie Gleason probably kind of played the part of Oney Madden, and Mickey Rooney would have, I'm not sure who the actual fight manager was of Canara, but he would have played that part, and he was corrupt. But what it told was the story of a giant who had once been a champion boxer and then was later exploited by an unscrupulous manager and another promoter, Jackie Gleason, as a professional wrestler. So this guy's, La Strada for his early life, The Harder They Fall for his boxing life, and Requiem for a Heavyweight for his later life as a wrestler.
He gets movie roles, and then he gets movies kind of made about the premise of his life.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
But I don't know if that really pays anything.
Yeah, it doesn't pay very much. He made some money as this kind of washed up former personality who was a boxer wrestling. Of course, wrestling's all show anyhow, but it's a I don't know. And guy, that's why I wanted to do this. It's such an interesting life this guy had. In his heyday, Canara had been called the Ambling Alp or the Man Mountain, and he was a bigger-than-life character ever since. The intrigue and tragedy that marked his life was a great story sources for movies. As you just said, Aaron, he inspired them. He inspired movies. He starred in them. He had some movie stars around like George Raft to help him with his boxing career. Later on, he would file a lawsuit against Columbia Studios for the movie The Harder They Fall because he claimed it damaged his reputation, and which would have damaged his career. He did. Here's another little truth is stranger than fiction sometimes. He became good friends with his last major opponent, Max Baer. And Max Baer actually had a role in that The Harder They Fall, and he was very disappointed with him, but he still remained his friend. He was such a friend to Max Baer that after Max Baer died, he wasn't able to get to his funeral. He was still alive, and he came over to the United States, and he made a special trip to go to Max Baer's grave. He lost that lawsuit, and he was never compensated for his life story from anybody. In the movie, it said one promoter grumbles, "There's no real fighters anymore. They're all actors. The best showman becomes the champ." And Primo Canara was the best showman in the 1930s, and he did become the champ for a period of time. So that's kind of the story of Primo Canara, and I know it's not a real mob story. It just kind of was, it was connected to the Irish mobsters, but I just thought it was a really interesting little slice of life that comes out of that seamy underworld of
Of the Westies?
Of the Westies and the mob and New York City and the fight game. You've always heard that the fight game was rigged back in the day, and I don't think it is anymore. I just had that fight the other night with Floyd Mayweather and what was that? I think it's an Irish guy, too. I keep wanting to say Ewan McGregor, but...
isn't it McGregor?
It's McGregor, yeah, the mixed martial arts guy. I guess Mayweather beat him like a stepchild, too. Although well, maybe, I'm wrong about that, I'll hear that from the people.
Was Oney Madden managing him?
Yeah, well, if Oney Madden was managing him, had money on him, he definitely would have won. All right, if you have a friend or a loved one that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks, you need to go out and get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for sale on Amazon. Also, you need to get the app, Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can get your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And you want to get the book, Leaving Vegas.
Now, FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Get the written copy, but you'll want to get the Kindle as well so you can hear the words from the mouth of the men that did it. Original recordings from the Argent files condensed down to tell the story of skimming in Vegas from the mouth of the men that did it.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Find them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.
The subcommittee will be in order. Our next witness will be Mr. Nicodemus Scarfo of Atlantic City, New Jersey. Given the amount of testimony introduced before the subcommittee relating to Mr. Scarfo, the subcommittee has deemed it appropriate and necessary to call Mr. Scarfo personally and to provide him with the opportunity to respond to the evidence now before us. Mr. Scarfo's appearance is pursuant to a subcommittee subpoena. Mr. Scarfo, if you would please stand and raise your right hand. Do you swear that the testimony that you are about to give before this subcommittee is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yeah, I will.
Please be seated. I would ask you, Mr. Scarfo, in addition to giving your name and address, that you introduce your counsel.
Mr. Robert Simone.
And where does he practice?
You want him to answer that?
Yes, I would like the witness to
Philadelphia.
Answer.
Philadelphia.
Mr. Scarfo, where do you currently reside?
Your Honor, may I make a brief explanation of Mr. Scarfo's current status and position? I promise it will be brief.
Yes, yeah. With the assurance that it will be brief, we will permit it.
Mr. Scarfo is presently here in pursuant to the subpoena. I had some communications with counsel for the committee, and at that time I advised counsel for the committee that Mr. Scarfo would be invoking his rights under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and possibly under the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. The reason for the explanation is this, that Mr. Scarfo is presently involved in an appellate procedure in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in which we are contesting the legality of a search of his premises in relation to a case that is pending on appeal. Certain records were taken from a drawer in his apartment, and that search is now the subject of a decision that is pending in the Court of Appeals. It's already been argued. So I wanted to explain why we would be possibly invoking a Fourth Amendment right as well as a Fifth Amendment right. Also, since Mr. Scarfo received the subpoena, certain agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation came with a search warrant to not his home, but the office of Scarf, Inc. And you've already heard testimony that Mr. Scarfo spends a great deal of time in there. And with this search warrant, Mr. Scarfo's sister, who lives in the same building, Mr. Scarfo's mother, Mr. Scarfo, and others were not permitted to remain while the search was going on, and they were taken out of the building. We believe, although cannot prove, and we've heard nothing to the contrary, that the place was at that time wired or bugged. As a result, Mr. Scarfo and myself, as his attorney, believe that possibly his Sixth Amendment right to counsel may have been infringed upon. And I just wanted to explain that to the panel. I understand he also does not have immunity.
First, I confirm that Mr. Scarfo does not have immunity. But we intend to proceed with the questions, and of course, you can take appropriate action, and we will review your objections at that time. Mr. Scarfo, where do you currently reside?
26 North Georgia Avenue, Atlantic City, New Jersey.
Have you ever been convicted of a crime?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the question.
What do you do for a living?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the question.
Do you know Frank Gerace, the president of Local 54 of the Hotel and Restaurant Employee Union?
Same answer, sir.
What has been your relationship with Frank Gerace?
Same answer, sir.
Have you ever discussed Local 54 business with Frank Gerace?
Same answer, sir.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. He's giving this answer, same answer, just to save time, unless you prefer that he read his Fifth Amendment reason.
Are you saying that irrespective of what the question?
No, sir. He'll not irrespective of the question, but when he says same answer, he's referring to his Fifth Amendment right alone.
His Fifth Amendment. Right. Did you know Angelo Bruno and Phil Testa?
Same answer, sir.
What was your relationship with Bruno and Testa?
Same answer, sir.
Do you have any knowledge concerning the identities of anyone responsible for the murder of Angelo Bruno?
Same answer, sir.
Do you have any knowledge concerning the identity of anyone responsible for the murder of Phil Testa?
Same answer, sir.
Mr. Scarfo, why did you maintain the phone numbers of Frank Gerace and Sue Holland in a coded system of records?
I refuse to answer the question on the grounds of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments of the United States Constitution.
Did you know Robert Lumio?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the question.
What was your relationship with Robert Lumio?
Same answer, sir.
Did you ever discuss Local 54 business with Robert Lumio?
Same answer, sir.
Do you know any of the following individuals associated with Local 54? Al Diadone, D-I-A-D-O-N-E, Vice President, Eli Kirkland, Organizer, Carlos Lassane, Grievance Manager.
Same answer, sir.
Do you know Frank Latino?
Same answer, sir.
What has been your relationship with Frank Latino?
Same answer, sir.
Did you ever have any discussions with Phil Testa concerning the appointment of the consigliere for the Bruno family?
Same answer, sir.
Do you know any members of the Genovese or Gambino crime families?
Same answer, sir.
Have you filed income tax returns since 1975?
Same answer, sir.
Senator Rutland?
What if you might tell us about the trial that you underwent in 1980. Just tell us what you were charged with.
Joseph Salerno's statement, testimony, and you were found not guilty.
I was charged with murder on the strength of Joe Salerno's testimony, and I was also found not guilty.
I understand that. You were acquitted.
Yes.
Who else was tried with you? Could you tell us that, please? Who are your fellow defendants?
Lawrence Molino and Philip Leonetti, which are also acquitted.
And the name of the deceased again? The man who was killed by someone?
Vincent Falcone.
Say again, please.
Vincent Falcone.
Could you spell that last name, please, just for me?
F-A-L-C-O-N-E.
And was he a friend of yours?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the questions.
And how old are you, Ms. Scarpa?
53.
And where were you born?
Brooklyn, New York.
And how long have you been in the business of Scarf Incorporated? How long have you had that business?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the question.
I'm going to ask counsel to have Mr. Scarf advise him again. Did he get your instruction correctly? I just asked him at what time Scarf Incorporated was in business.
Well,
did he understand your...
Yeah, the question presumes something that's not a fact, sir. Mr. Scarf is not related to Scarf Inc. It's his nephew, Philip Leonetti.
I see.
That was the testimony.
I wonder if you might tell me how long the gentleman on your left, Mr. Simone, has represented you as your counsel.
Four or five years, sir.
Uh-huh. And do you own any real estate anywhere at all?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the question.
Well, are you currently employed?
Same answer, sir.
Do you have a safe deposit box anywhere?
Same answer, sir.
And did you see Ralph Natale this morning as he came into the building here?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Is he a friend of yours?
Same answer, sir.
How long have you known Ralph Natale?
Same answer, sir.
I think the record is replete and complete.
Mr. Scarfo, I have to state very plainly and bluntly that I'm disappointed. Disappointed that you have answered none of the questions propounded either by Senator Rudman or myself. You have sat here this morning and your name and involvement in matters under investigation by this subcommittee have been prominently mentioned and discussed. And we think it's important that you answer these questions. Now, the subcommittee is going to be continuing to proceed with these investigations, and we will take your taking the Fifth and other objections under advisement. I admit and recognize that you have a constitutional right to take the Fifth Amendment where it incriminates yourself, but very candidly, in any number of these questions, it's extraordinarily difficult to see why this action is appropriate. This will conclude the questioning of you, Mr. Scarfo. As I said, we will perhaps be back in contact with you. And the subcommittee is in recess until tomorrow morning at
thank you very much.
10 o'clock.
Sir, your attorney, I need
Bob.
Crazy. Oh, man, I don't know.
I want to plant the seed. I don't know how to cry. That's S-I-M-O-N-A.
S-I-M-O-N-A in your first name.